Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I mean, these plants are already waiting to go in the ground, so by April, May at the market, you know, they're going to be wonderful. They'll be perfect.
That's Salem Willard from inside the hoop house at Bread and Roses Gardens. Despite the frigid temperatures still, plants are thriving inside this plastic dome. Along with fellow gardener Jonas Carpenter, he talks about starting plants indoors to make your spring garden that much more successful. We visit the Bloomington Winter Farmers Market to buy tomatoes and berries, believe it or not. Chef Daniel Orr cooks with some spaghetti squash. And Harvest Public Media asks the question that drives seed company executives and farmers alike: how can we grow more crops? Stay with us. Our food news headlines start off every show. Luann Johnson is here to give us the info. Welcome.
Our Earth Eats news bloggers followed three stories this week. The Senate passed a bill Wednesday to avert the furloughs of meat inspectors throughout the U.S. That was part of a larger piece of legislation that aims to keep government agencies funded through the end of September. The measure reallocates $55 million from USDA school equipment grants and maintenance budgets to the Food Safety and Inspection Service. It will enable meat processors to remain on the job, thereby preventing interruptions of the nation's meat supply. Because meat processors cannot operate without inspectors on site, meat processors remain braced to close their doors for 11 days between July and September if the bill doesn't pass the House. The disruption could cost the industry up to $10 billion, according to Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, and employees could stand to lose more than $400 million in wages. Senator Mark Pryor co-sponsored the bill with Senator Roy Blunt, House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, and House Appropriations Committee Chairman Hal Rogers. Both say they expect the bill to pass the House with few or no amendments. With no amendments to the sequester, the federal government faces a large-scale shutdown of programs starting next week. Until recently, arguments over genetically modified organism labeling has been on a localized state-by-state basis. With 20 states proposing bills that would make labeling products with GMOs mandatory, the fight is going nationwide. In 2012, California narrowly voted down Proposition 37, which would have required labeling on products with genetically altered material. States currently hearing GMO labeling legislation include Missouri, Iowa, Illinois, and Indiana, among others. Lawmakers like Jared Polis of Denver, Oregon Democrat Peter DeFazio, and California Democrat Barbara Boxer are forming to take the fight national. Earlier this month, Whole Foods announced it would label all GMO products in the U.S. and Canadian stores by 2018. This week, Whole Foods went one step further and proclaimed it would not sell genetically modified seafood, with Trader Joe's and other U.S. retailers agreeing to do the same. With Aqua Bounty Aqua Advantage salmon slated to become the first genetically modified fish to hit the U.S. markets, the retailers' announcements come at a pivotal time. As demands for GMO labeling grow louder, lawmakers wonder what will happen if an individual state passes a labeling law. Labeling can become tricky. With up to 80% of processed foods in the U.S. containing GMOs, labeling would mean tracing ingredients. And, according to a March 14 announcement made by Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, USDA Deputy Secretary Kathleen Merrigan will be stepping down from her position. While she has not given a reason for leaving, it is unusual for deputy secretaries to stay on for more than one term. Merrigan, known for the Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food initiative, has been celebrated by sustainability advocates. Under her tenure, farmers' markets have increased in number and begun to accept SNAP, or Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, benefits. Read more about these stories on our website, eartheats.org, and get the latest in food news by following us on Twitter and Facebook.
Luann Johnson, bringing us the food news headlines. Thanks.
My pleasure.
We continue now with Harvest Public Media's three-part series on the science of the seed. Over the past several weeks, we've considered the beginnings of genetic modification and how control of the technology is changing as patents expire. Today, we wrap up with the question that drives seed company executives and farmers alike: how can we grow more crops? Amy Mayer, reporting from Iowa, looks at how seed innovations push the boundaries of what the land can produce.
Dave Bubeck heads up research at the Iowa-based seed company DuPont Pioneer. He says farmers want one thing from seed improvements.
Grain yield, grain yield, grain yield.
After all, he says, that's what they get paid for, the amount of sellable crop grown on their land.
We want to maximize that. And so that's always foremost in our selection criteria every step of the way.
Bubeck says there's no one answer for all farms.
It really comes down to an individual farmer's product management approaches, the soil type, just the whole regimen of farming practices that an individual farmer has.
So this is an open house for...
Research scientist Goran Snernich visits with farmers, seed dealers, and retirees at this open house at a DuPont Pioneer Research Center near Des Moines. He talks them through how a new corn hybrid gets to market.
Setting up the testing so that we can maximize information based on our data and advance the right products to the farmers here in this area.
On visits like this, farmers get a look inside the seed companies they rely on. Amid explanatory posters and plenty of seeds are glimpses of enhancements underway. The Vital Seed has evolved from humble origins into big business. At DuPont Pioneer, grain yield has increased about 1-2% per year for decades. Retired DuPont Pioneer corn breeder Bill Ambrose says this modern lab with its high-tech equipment and ability to transform genes leaves him amazed at the technologies researchers use today.
We could do a few hundred things, and they do mega thousands of things.
Partly for that reason, DuPont Pioneer projects consistent continued yield growth, meaning in another generation, we could be seeing yields as unimaginable today as today's were 25 or 50 years ago. Weed, insect, and drought-resistant seeds are readily available now. The future could include seeds that process nitrogen differently, for example, or produce greater nutrition. At Iowa State University's Seed Lab, seeds are divided for germination and purity testing. Lab manager Mike Starr sees myriad potential directions for seed development.
They're going to keep on looking for ways that will either make the seeds grow better, be easier to harvest, be easier to store.
Perhaps eventually, farmers will plant various seeds within a field or even row.
Someday, there may be such a thing as where they'll apply different seed types in a different part of the field. Maybe one part's low and needs a variety that can handle wet feet, and other part of the field might be ideal conditions.
Because something scientists and farmers both know is this: the quest for the perfect seed won't end with just one. I'm Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. The two guys of Bread and Roses Gardens are pretty busy these days. They're transplanting starter plants from the hoop house into the ground. They're sheet mulching and creating raised garden beds. Luckily, they have help with composting and clearing the land from their various animals. The result of all this work will be growing food to sell at summer farmers markets. But the system here on the farm and homestead is really the focus. One of Salem Willard's many titles is part owner of Bread and Roses Gardens.
Farmer, permaculture designer, edible landscaper, woodsman, nurseryman. I don't know. I'm running out, but there is not a very clear title, obviously.
Well, we're seeing a lot of cool stuff to look at, but I'm looking at the living things over there. If we could go over there
Absolutely. First
and introduce me to your chickens.
Sure. I don't know if you remember when you were here 2 years ago.
I do.
Just in the process of getting this thing started.
Willard had just started the arduous task of turning this rustic plot of land near the Hoosier National Forest into a farm and homestead. Back then, he only had one rooster and three pigs. Now he's up to a dozen or so chickens and ducks.
The chicken moat now is completed. It's been in place for a year and a half now. It's been functioning incredibly well. Basically, the chickens surround the entire garden. They eat whatever we throw in there, and they actively compost everything for us, so we don't have to do the work.
I'm seeing a lot of bagels and sweet potatoes.
Yep.
And we actually grow things to feed them, and our weeds a lot of the time, too, and they love it.
That's Jonas Carpenter. It's called a moat because it surrounds the garden, not because there's any water involved.
Well, there's one group of chickens called the Borg because they all kind of have one mentality. They all kind of work together.
Share a conscience.
Yeah, exactly. The ducks have a lot more personality, so they have individual names. There's Sir Francis, Drake.
Chadwick.
Creighton.
The khaki babies. They're a type of duck called khaki Campbells. They're the most productive layers.
The garden inside the moat doesn't have much growing in it right now. It's still a bit too early to see plants popping up. But in the greenhouse, that's a different story altogether. The kale is flourishing. They took cuttings from last year's kale plants and planted them in the greenhouse. Oh, it's nice and toasty in here.
Yeah, we're able to keep it nice and warm. I mean, earlier before I opened up the doors, it was up in the 80s or even higher. So it stays really warm, and it provides. This is just a high tunnel, so all we have is plastic, film. We did double the layer, so it would add a little bit of extra insulation. And we found that we've been growing perennial herbs, actually, that we're trying some new varieties of. We have American licorice, Baptisia, which is a native wildflower that's nitrogen fixing. So it improves the quality of the soil. Clove.
Yeah.
Clove. Oh, okay, clove. We're growing clove.
Yeah, I mean, there's some more common stuff here. I mean, we have fennel and celery and parsley, caraway, chervil.
And mustard greens and kales and a lot of lettuces and cilantro, and all of our herbs have been pretty much growing through the year despite the cold.
We're not using any heating other than just the solar gain. And really, I mean, the key here is not to be like really pumping and growing a lot during the winter, but just sustaining. I mean, the ground never freezes in here. So we're able to just kind of extend both seasons, being spring and fall. We'll go into winter and out of winter with a really big kickstart.
You can see a lot of our perennials in here too. Like sorrel is just lush. I mean, it's happy. It's doing great.
And will that go in the ground at some point?
Well, actually these we'll take to market this year.
For people like me to put in the ground.
Absolutely. Yes, for people like you. So we'll have a head start. I mean, these plants are already waiting to go in the ground. So by April, May at the market, they're going to be wonderful. They'll be perfect. So
what I'm looking at is a piece of, some sort of newspaper that's very wet that's just put directly onto the soil. What's the point of that?
So what that does is it helps retain moisture in the soil because seeds don't really need light to germinate. They just need a moist soil base. And so the newspaper just helps keep the soil wet and not soggy. You don't want soggy soil, and that way you'll see the newspaper dry. You'll know that it's starting to dry out a little bit more.
A lot of people even can, for certain kinds of seeds, you can keep them in a wet paper towel in a Ziploc bag in the fridge, and you can cause the seeds to germinate that way. That's good for cool or plants that like cool weather, like the ones we've been talking about. Also, a lot of medicinal herbs prefer that. They like a cold period before they can germinate.
Don't have a massive hoop house in your backyard? Not a problem. You can start your plants indoors and then transplant them to pots when the outside temperatures heat up.
If you have the space, a sunroom, a sunny window, some people use like grow lights to start indoors. But now's a great time to get your early, what farmers call cool crops, which would be, your kale, cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, all your early greens. Now's a good time to start to get it, just to get ahead.
They'll benefit from more cold. So you can, if you get them started inside early, then you can still plant them outside at an earlier stage. I mean, kales typically will survive temperatures as low as 15 degrees. There's a sneak peek at what's in the future for hopefully Bloomington. There's a number of citrus trees that I'm going to be experimenting with in here in the future. There are certain varieties of mandarin oranges that will survive down to 10 degrees. And, this year the lowest temperature we got was 7 degrees. So if you can keep the high tunnel an extra 15 degrees warmer, they'll make it just fine through the winter.
local citrus in southern Indiana. We'll definitely be keeping an eye on that one. Next week, Salem Willard and Jonas Carpenter will be back to talk about sheet mulching. You want to convert your front lawn into a garden? You'll want to hear their advice for sure. In the meantime, see pictures of Bread and Roses Gardens on our website, eartheats.org. Coming up, we pay another visit to the Bloomington Winter Farmers Market. Teresa Bertels planned ahead in the fall and saved some of her massive harvest of heirloom tomatoes to sell several months later.
While the price may drop when there's plenty, well, then in the winter, when there isn't that local fresh available, we do have local frozen available.
Freezing the fall harvest to sell in the spring. Good for business and tasty for consumers. And after that, Chef Daniel Orr cooks with a veggie you might still have in your root cellar, spaghetti squash. Stay with us. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Every week, we speak with authors of everything from cookbooks to food history books. This week, we chatted with Anna Blessing, whose new book, Locally Grown, celebrates the relationships Chicago restaurants have with their area farms that provide their food. A regular shopper at farmers markets, Blessing says she wanted to tell the stories of small artisanal producers. After a little research, she found out she wasn't the only one.
I started talking to chefs in Chicago, and those chefs, they wouldn't stop talking about those farmers because they got so excited about them, and they wanted to tell their stories, and they wanted to tell every last detail of how they grow their food and what they learned when they went to their farm. And I just realized that it is a very contagious subject.
Here's 1 minute with author Anna Blessing.
I mean, you would actually be amazed at how many of these chefs have been to all of their farms that they source from. They're bringing along their whole kitchen crew, you know, see what it's like to eat a watermelon grown right there and just cracked open and eaten fresh as it could ever be. So I think that chefs, it's not just that they want to source locally. The ones who are really, really committed to it, they really want to know their farmers and they want to have these relationships with them. And, you know, it's such a two-way relationship. It's not just as simple as the chef's buying food from the farmer. It's much more about a collaborative relationship. So the farmer is asking the chef, what do you want me to grow? What amazing, you know, different varieties could I grow for you that I could try out? And the chef is planning menus around what the farmers are growing or what is in season in their region that, you know, moment in time. And that's what you start to see in these collaborations, where Peter Klein at Seedling, he did a collaboration with Carrie Nahabedian at Naha in Chicago, where he grew pears in bottles so that she could then bottle her own pear cores. And so it becomes just kind of one more way to just be so creative in what they're already doing.
Perfect. Thank you, Anna. This has been awesome.
Thank you so much, Annie.
Have a good one.
Bye.
Bye. Read more about Anna Blessing's new book, Locally Grown, on our website, eartheats.org. The Bloomington Winter Farmers Market is nearly finished for the season, one more Saturday in the month of March to go. The argument that you can't eat locally in the Midwest in the cold months is totally debunked by this one particular farmer today. Among other things, she's selling various squashes. She explains that it took some forethought back in the fall to harvest these veggies with an eye on selling them in the spring.
Yes, I'm Teresa Bertels from Heartland Family Farms, and today we have butternuts, buttercups, delicatas, and acorns, and they're part of our winter storage. They were harvested in the fall and then stored. I actually recycle apple boxes, and so I store them, and then they come to market every week. We also have popcorn. Three different varieties of an heirloom popcorn, a white popcorn, a red popcorn, and a blue popcorn, and they were also harvested last fall. And then we strip it off the cob as we get a chance during the fall. So that's one of those jobs that we can put on hold and do in a little bit. Hi, it will be $2.
Okay.
Thank you.
Talk about the popcorn. That's what I'm really curious about.
Oh, it's so good. These are the old open pollinated varieties that actually my grandmother grew. When I was a little girl, she grew popcorn, she grew peanuts, those old time things. You know, they didn't just go to the store. They grew what they wanted. And in the winter, they loved to set, and they had the old hand crank popcorn popper, which I still have, and just sat and visited. You know, there wasn't all that electronic media and all this other stuff. They just visited, and all the uncles and aunts and cousins would get together. So we started growing the popcorn. It's been really popular. And then, of course, we have our free-range eggs from our happy hens. We love our hens. They're part of the family. And my daughter, Sarah, makes wreaths, and she also, in the fall, harvests her herbs, basil and lavender, oregano, thyme, sage, and makes up herb packages, and she has those for sale. And then the final thing that we have today, we have frozen blackberries and frozen heirloom tomatoes. Of course, they're good for soups and sauces. You know, you have that structural issue that you always have when you freeze anything. So your cell walls are going to be soft, so it's not a firm tomato. But to make soup with, oh my gosh, you just use an immersion blender or a blender or a Foley food mill, and just, it's fabulous.
Enjoy.
We started doing this, especially with the frozen heirloom and Roma tomatoes and cherry tomatoes and the fruit, because there's such a bulk of it, such a glut, generally speaking, unless you have a late frost, and then you have no fruit to sell. But since fruit is very perishable, we decided, oh, we're just going to start freezing this, and then we have it so we can make our own product. You know, we do a value-added jam, jelly, and then we also do a value-added blackberry and strawberry finishing sauce. And then when we're finished doing that, we generally still have berries left, and they go to chefs, and then they go to the market.
So am I hearing you correctly that this is a way to keep you from throwing food away or letting food rot on the vine?
Right, and if in a farm business perspective, it's also a way for a farmer not to take a really low price when there's a glut of food in a particular season. So while the price may drop when there's plenty, well, then in the winter, when there isn't that local fresh available, we do have local frozen available.
Yeah.
Thank you. This was fantastic.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Thanks to Teresa Bertels of Heartland Family Farm for balancing her customers at the Bloomington Winter Farmers Market with our conversation. See photos of the market and read and listen to other farmer profiles on our website, eartheats.org. We sent out a call to our listeners and readers last season to ask what ingredients you wanted us to cook with, and many of you mentioned spaghetti squash. This easy recipe takes no time at all, and it's gluten-free.
Okay, and you can see how when we pull these seeds out, there are these little strings almost like spaghetti that come out. Okay, and that's why they call it, obviously, spaghetti squash. And the best way to get the seeds out of the pulp is to put them in a bowl, fill the bowl with cold water, and then all you do is you just kind of go like this, and all the seeds will come off the interior, and then you can just roast them or fry them or however you want to use them. Okay, what I usually do is throw them in my compost, and then hopefully they'll come up next year.
Exactly.
So, you know, get a lot of volunteers and, you know, coming up in the funniest little places. Okay, and then what you do is you could rub this with a little bit of oil or not, put your spaghetti squash cut side down, put about a half inch of water in there, and then roast it in the oven for about 40 to 45 minutes. And then you can just take a fork, you could even serve this as a bowl, like spaghetti, and then put some Parmesan cheese on it. So I've got one that I've already cooked, but this one I roasted whole. And a lot of times what I'll do is when I cook it like this, I'll just cut out a little window into it and open it up. Okay, scrape out the seeds. All right, and then you just take your fork and go around, pull all the squash out, and you want just kind of rake it. You don't want to break those strands up too much. Okay, we'll pour that into a bowl. Okay, and then you can season it with whatever you like. If you like red sauce, anything that you would do with spaghetti. What I'm going to do is toss it with some Parmesan cheese, chopped garlic, a little lemon zest, maybe a little crushed red pepper flakes. Okay, and then I'm going to use some truffle oil and toss this up. And then you could stuff it back into the shell, maybe a little sprinkle of Parmesan on top. And you've got a really nice spaghetti squash dinner that all your gluten-free friends can enjoy.
And then when you're done using the spaghetti squash shell as a bowl, tie a string through it and hang it as a bird feeder just in time for spring. How about that? See a photo of the dish on our website, eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Aabon Binder, Teresa Bertels, Jonas Carpenter, Sarah Gordon, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Salem Willard, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thank you for listening. Till next week, happy eating, everybody. I'm Annie Corrigan.